Hello, welcome to Outside In. I'm John Burns, and this is my podcast for people who like to be outdoors, but for obvious reasons are indoors right now. My guest today is well known as the Moonwalker. He's a nocturnal, was, I don't know if he still is, a nocturnal perambulator, and he's not a part of the dark side, I'm glad to say, but he's produced another 3 books out of his experiences and his life in the hills. And so I thought I'd bring him along to have a chat to him today. My guest today is Alan Rowan. Hello, Alan. How are you?
Hi, John. I'm good.
I was just remembering that we organised a performance for me. I performed with for Dundee Mountaineering Club a while ago.
It's a Grampian Club, yeah.
That's Grampian right. Club. That was it. That was it. And they stared at me as if I was a creature from the Black Lagoon. I remember that.
I think one or two of them were stunned.
I think they were stunned. I think they were or stupefied by it. I'm not too sure. I very rarely am what people expect, to be honest. So tell me, you've moved on from your Moonwalker books, which have been really successful, and you've produced a number of ebooks. Tell us about those ebooks then. How did they come about?
Well, I felt Moonwalker came with a trilogy, it came to a proper ending with two books, but almost historic about years ago, and then finish it with a modern one by trying to do the same thing again and Mountain to the Moon, doing it in the full moons. So that brought it to an end. But there was so much material over the last 8 years with regular blogs and features and things that for almost like a record of my own work, I wanted to put these out, but I wanted to do them. The ebooks, they're $1.99 each, but they're the same size books as like Moonwalker. So you're talking about 70,000 words of writing. And they're broken down into like there's 4 main features in each book. And in between are the blogs, and the blogs are all linked together. There's one from 2014, one from 2018, one from 2020, but they're all on the same subject. And so they're packed into chapters. So there's 21 chapters altogether. So you get 17 chapters of different subjects with blogs specifically on that thing. And there's obviously going to be a bit of miscellaneous and this and that. So things that don't naturally fit into a category go into that chapter as well. So when I started doing it, I ended up with enough material for probably four of these books. But there'd been people asking about the blogs, having them all in one place and all the writing and so on. So I just decided to do them as ebooks and have them. I came up with the Moonwalker Chronicles, which I thought would be a kind of like play on them.
Yeah, I like that.
And all they're going to do is it's going to be Moonwalker Chronicles 2, Moonwalker Chronicles 3. There's enough for a fourth one, but that'll be maybe next year. Mm-hmm. It's just basically put all the stuff down in record. But they're also handy if you want to have someone on your Kindle just for when you're on the bus or the train, when we get back on the buses and trains. But you can dip in and out of it, and you don't need to, you know, it's easy to find little bits to read that you'll enjoy. You'll enjoy some of it. Some of it you might have seen before because it has appeared, as I say, in some other publications at times.
Yes, yes.
But there are little tweaks on them. What I haven't done is gone back and changed them all retrospectively. If there's obvious mistakes or, just basically any obvious mistakes have been changed. But I wanted to keep the feeling of the time. So even if it's not the way I feel now about something that's from 2014, I might have a slightly different take on it in 2020. But I think that's quite important because it documents a lot. There's a lot of things with, for instance, the Monroe Society now at Perth Library are documenting as many mountaineering experiences possible over the years. And that obviously is going to change.
Tell me about that bit more about that project. Well, this is the Monroe Society, yeah?
Monroe Society, yeah.
What exactly are they putting together then?
Well, the Monroe Society, as you know, it was set up about 20 years ago. Ostensibly for folk who'd done all the Monroes, but it's kind of spread wider now, and it's a non-profit organisation. What it does, the membership fees and any money they make from publications and things all go into like Trees for Life and path building and so on. So
okay.
They donated about £4,000 or £5,000 a year on different projects. They split it up. For instance, the path building project, they gave £914.40, which is the height of a Munro. So and things like that, you know. So, but they what they've done is they've got a massive library based at Perth Library, and it's a different people's mountaineer experience, and there's lots of it's like slides and so on. And they're about to try and do a small film about the Munro legacy and so on, things like that. So I think it's quite important to have your own hill history as part of it. And you know, when you pass on, there's somewhere for that to go, hopefully. So it's not all just wasted, and that people can access it at some point in the future if they want to look at different things. I mean, you'll be familiar with this, John. You must be fascinated by looking at pictures from the 30s and 40s and things like that, the same place as you are now.
I'm quite fascinated by looking at. I often look at pictures from not quite as far. I don't go quite that far back, but certainly it's quite interesting to look at photos of the 70s, for example. And I noticed that much to my chagrin that hair. Was very much in fashion. Now I haven't got any hair now, but I had a hell of a me and all my mates had ridiculous amounts of the stuff in those days, yeah, you know. Yeah. But I also what's really interesting to see, and it does take you back a bit, is to look at the kind of gear we had in those days, or more accurately, the kind of gear we didn't have, because most of the gear in those days was crap. We had
army surplus stores, wasn't it? People just picking up
army surplus stores. It was all heavy, and
you weighed an extra couple of stone at the end of the day.
That's right. And of course, we had the nylon cagoule, which was basically the way that worked was nylon cagoule. There was so much condensation when you put it on, you had a choice really between leaving it off and when it was raining and you'd be cold and wet, or you could put it on and you'd be warm and wet. There wasn't much, you're basically going to be wet whichever way you went. But so presumably those are the kind of things that the Munro Society are putting together, is it?
Yes, yeah, they've got a lot of old archive photos. I mean, I did a thing with Dundee University Rucksack Club once, and it was quite interesting seeing. I was talking about the 30s there, and I was talking about the 1920s at the foot of Ben Aglow. And what was remarkable about it, how it hasn't changed. The scenery really hadn't changed that much. I mean, obviously, there'd be the difference in the tree and the path and things like that.
Yes.
But the mountain itself really hadn't changed, but the people standing in front of it had. You're saying, the different gear. And they used to take days to get there. So it was set off about 2 days in advance and come back, holiday trip. And there was a great excitement when somebody had a car and drove up. It still took 2 days.
It's things have changed radically in the way that we address the hills, really. Whether they've changed the better, I don't know. Obviously, one of the biggest changes that I've found is that, you know, the internet has changed everything for everybody. And years ago, in the 70s and the 80s, really, if you wanted to know where a bothy was, or you wanted to know about a climb maybe, or you wanted to know about what sort of gear to use, or you kind of had to join a club and meet people and talk about it. Whereas these days, there's just a plethora of information on the internet. But it almost feels sometimes as though there's too much. People really don't know how to sift through it, you know.
Well, that's why I still prefer using old maps. I prefer map and compass, because I find there's still that kind of wee bit of mystery involved if you use a map. Whereas I find a lot of these apps now where you just follow the line or whatever, you know, I don't find it quite as interesting. They're no doubt they're handy and they're safety and so on and so on.
Yeah.
But I think sometimes you can be over-reliant on it and not really discover the land almost, you know.
Well, of course, I completely agree. I mean, my Luddite tendencies are well known, and certainly I have resisted very strongly switching over to GPS from paper maps. But recently, in about the last year or so, my eyesight has become so bad that, particularly in low light levels, I just had to say to myself, you can't read these maps anymore. And there's an alternative in a GPS that you really should use. So I have switched across the GPS. But I do agree with you, because I think that, you know, if you're there with map and compass, you've got a stronger connection with the landscape, I think. Because
I definitely think so.
You know, you have to interpret it for yourself. You have to try and work out where you've come from, where you've been, where you're going.
And there's contours, you know.
And there's contours, yeah, which, surprisingly enough, I've noticed, art don't actually exist in real life. I've never actually found the contour, you know.
That would be handy, wouldn't it?
It would be really handy, yeah.
It's the 500-meter line. Great.
Yeah, yeah. That would be great. Yeah, yeah. It would save a lot of hassle, really, wouldn't it? But yeah. So I have changed over, but I think you're right. I think. And one of the things also, I suppose, with the GPS, you know, it's you switch it on, it says you are here. But when I was sort of getting into the hills, I kind of took a pride on learning navigation. It was a skill. It was a skill you acquired, and you didn't acquire it easily. You know, the only way to learn navigation is kind of through experience and basically by getting lost. And
yeah.
I mean, you used to have been lost quite a bit, have you?
Yeah, quite a few times. not lost, temporarily misplaced, I think.
Temporarily misplaced, absolutely. Finding a different route, yes.
And then you sit down with a map. I remember sitting down once on this hill for about 10 minutes trying to figure out which glen this was and which hill I was actually on, because it strayed. But 5 or 10 minutes sitting there with a map brought a whole new meaning to it almost, because I suddenly went, oh, that's that, and I now know that area, and I now know that area, and I see where that is, and I see where that is. And it just... suddenly, it was like a eureka moment. You know, you're sitting there, no idea.
Yeah.
And then for 5 minutes of working this and that, and you suddenly knew everything of that part, you know, which was great.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I don't know if I've seen, there are some various ways of navigating that I use that I'm sure other people possibly do. But certainly, I've walked into Bothies in the dark quite regularly. One of the techniques I use, particularly from down by the coast, it can be quite handy. If you look down and you find that you're walking in seaweed, then it's a pretty good clue that you're by the sea, you know. But I was in Craigbothie, which is near Torridon. You know, it used to be a youth hostel. And one very dark night, I think it was December or something, and I was just going to bed. It was about 10 o'clock, half past 10. And these three Irish guys staggered in. And they'd been looking for the place for about 3 hours. But what they told, well, they'd done what is very easy to do, I find, particularly at night. If you going on a track into a bothy, get all tracks at night, all tracks, all gates look exactly the same. Mm-hmm. And what they'd done is they'd set off along this track, which was actually only about 30 feet from where the real track to starts. And one of the guys had been there before, and he just said, oh, it must be this way. And it wasn't. And they found the bothy. What they told me was they smelt the smoke from my fire about 2 miles away. And so they navigated to the bothy by smell. Which I thought that's pretty. I never heard of that before. But you must have, in all your blogs, what anything particularly stand out for you for sort of experiences that you've had?
Well, the night thing became. I became quite good at night navigation. It's what you're saying there about finding your way into places. You probably go slower a lot of the time.
Yes, you do.
Basically didn't go on open hillside. As you know, if it was a path or a track or whatever, then that would be best. The one time I did go off completely off, thinking I was taking a shortcut, was on the way into Chenevray. Fighting my way up through waist deep heather and boulders on a really steep slope just to find the path at the top of it. That happened occasionally, but that was also a classic walk, that one, because that was not right at the start but near the end of the first round of when it was end of the Moonwalker book, was Chenevray. Oh, right. Ones when it was such a long walk in from Inverleil.
Yes, it is.
I'm convinced to this day that I was sleepwalking, and I was, you know, some of the bigger trips in the later time when I was trying to rush to get it finished, there were a few incidents on that walk. First one was crossing the river. Now, I don't even remember crossing the river. Now, but when I went back with friends a few years later to take them the same way, as we were going up, we heard this thundering like Niagara, you know. And don't worry about it. We don't need to cross. We don't need to cross. We just cross a little stream. And then as we got nearer, I thought, no, no, this is what we're going to cross. And I must have crossed that in the dark and don't even remember it. But it was a beautiful night, so it might have been, the water might have been really low. We had to divert a mile upstream to get across that.
Yeah,
when I got to the summit of Shenavary, I remember sitting there and I'd actually fallen asleep for an hour. It was beautiful. It was an inversion. And I woke up and there were these goats. Now, you know, they're wild.
Oh, yes.
Goats looking for my sandwiches. I never, whatever pictures I took, because it was the old film camera, a lot of it didn't come out because of the light and so on. So I've never got any definite proof that there were any goats there. It could have just been a hallucination. I don't know.
It might have been.
So there were a few like that near the end, and Larvin was the same. Larvin was a bizarre one where I was coming out of that quarry and thinking people were talking to me all the time, and it was trees.
Oh, wow.
I thought it was a person, and I heard voices.
That is going in some, yeah.
Oh, was it was starting? There was two or three trips at that one, Shenavary, that one, and I think it was Scourmore, the big one in Arcaig. They were all long, long night trips.
Right.
They'd driven a long way as well. You know.
It was near the end of the
Monroe thing, and
I see.
I was determined to finish. I was trying to finish before the year 2000, which I didn't quite manage, but and pushed myself probably too much. I couldn't do it now.
No,
that was interesting. Lockdown last year, I did go back to night walking to avoid the crowds.
Uh-huh.
I started going back up at driving up at midnight, climbing at 2 a.m. because there was nobody else there. And
right.
It was down at 7 or 8 a.m. the car park rammed, you know.
Yes, even yes.
Even Mullerduch. Now, I've been up Mullerduch, I don't know, a dozen times, say. I've never seen more than one or two cars in that car park. This time, I couldn't get my car in at first.
Is that right?
So I just got out of the car and set off at like 3 a.m. And I got right round, virtually saw nobody all the way around.
Right.
Until out in the path. And by the time you got back out, you're still busy, you know?
Yeah. I mean, night navigation, it is pretty tricky. And I do agree with you that I've always found with moving at night is you think you've gone further than you have.
Yes.
I found that a lot. And also, one of the things, if you're out at night or as light levels get fairly low, you kind of lose all sense of perspective at times.
You could be
looking at, I don't know if it's your experience, but you could be looking at a feature that appears huge and you step into it, and it's actually 6 foot deep. I don't know if you ever found that.
Yes. Now, we had one when I was doing the full moon walks a couple of years back for the last book, and it was Ben A. And we set off at midnight from the car park, and we're walking in a beautiful full moon, great light. But of course, when you walk around into Corrie Machaerca, you lose the moonlight because of the wall of light, you see, for a little bit. So when you're in that corrie, the moonlight was showing a ridge going up to the left, which, you know, you climb, you go up and so on. But we kept going up, we kept following us up to that that gully in the corner that you're aiming for. And we weren't getting any closer. And the hill didn't seem to be making any climb. And then we realised that we're actually following, it wasn't a ridge, it was a moon shadow. So it was rising with us. So we were never going to get to the top of it.
Oh, wow, really? Oh, my God.
So we were trying to follow this line, which basically didn't exist. But we were rising, but you felt you were going higher almost, but never getting there.
Right. But you would eventually get there, I take it, would you?
We did eventually, yeah. We suddenly realised what it was. And it was quite handy, actually, because we couldn't get the song Moonshadow out of our head after that, because we suddenly realised this was what it was. We couldn't get it out of our head. So, you were going so crazy with a song going around in your head.
Another trick I've used, I don't know if you ever have, you know, sometimes if you're navigating along and you just follow your head torch beam, you know, trying to sort of navigate through somewhere, is actually to turn the head torch off Because then I've noticed, this is just my, if you've got your head torch beam on, all you can see is this little halo of light. And then you knock it off, and after your eyes adjust a little bit, you can then see the outline of the hills around you. And that, is that a technique that you sort of used?
Well, certainly the first, when I used to do it, like, let's say in the 90s and early in 2000s, up to 2009, my eyesight was a lot better for a start. I tended to try and not use a head torch at all.
Okay.
I tended not to use one. I had one, obviously. I had two.
Yes.
But I would only use it if it was like, for instance, doing a traverse of over Bray Rhiach and right round to the Devil's Point and back up Larigru.
In the Cairngorms, yeah.
You would go through the Calamon Gap. Now, the first hour and a bit to the Calamon Gap, I didn't have a head torch because the moon and I could see the path and all the rest. Going through the Calamon Gap would have been crazy not to have a head torch.
Yeah.
Because you're picking your way over boulders. So you had
it's a boulder strewn hell, basically, a little gap, isn't it? Yeah. A leg break. It's designed to break your legs. That's what it's designed. That's what it's there for. Yeah.
You're actually watching for holes rather than anything else.
It
would have been daft not to have the head torch on going through there. But as soon as you get to the other side, I was able to put it off again. And of course, as you say, your eyes adjust to the light quicker anyway. When I was doing the ones last year, I had the head torch on maybe for the first 20 minutes, half an hour, for most of the walks, because all the days I was going out were basically good. So you're getting it, and it was summer, because you remember, we basically didn't get anywhere April, May, June. So it was July, August, September, I did most of my walking further away. It was actually quite a good summer. There was a lot of really good days in it. So I was picking and choosing and going around a lot of the big ridges. So you're starting off maybe 20 minutes with a head torch just to get out of the car park, basically.
Yeah.
What you're saying, we put the head torch off, you started getting the skyline and the locks and things like that. And then with the light coming up gradually. I think Mullerdyk was the most fantastic night sky I've ever seen just for... couldn't believe the stars. It was like the sky was almost white with them. I've never seen so many. So
wow, really? Oh, that sounds amazing. You do. I think you get obviously the atmosphere of the hills is different at night, isn't it?
It is, yes.
It's like a secret sort of place in some ways.
Funnily enough, the deer seem to get spooked less at night. We were in that Ben E one I was talking about. We were walking in and we just saw about a few feet away from us, all these yellow eyes, and the breath, it was like demons almost. But
I've seen that, yeah.
They were fascinated, they were more interested, curious.
Well, I can tell you why that is. There you go. That's because at night, deer have obviously learned to treat men as predators, which obviously clearly we are to them. But the way they recognize you is by your outline. So if they can't see your outline, they can't recognize you as a threat. So that's why at night, they're, as you say, they appear to be a lot tamer. That makes sense.
Yes, it does. The other thing I heard as well was that if you wear much brighter colors, deer are much more spooked with folk wearing kind of camouflage colors, if you know what I mean. If you wear bright colors, well, basically because they can see where you are and where you're moving.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So it made sense that I just wondered why a circus clown has never climbed all on the nose.
Well, maybe he has, for all we know. I've seen a few clowns out there when I've been there, I can tell you. Very good. So,
I only count clown car park, the one that fell apart every so often, you know, that was it.
What was that, sorry?
I only had the clown car, the one that kind of fell apart.
Okay, oh God, yeah. Well, that used to be part of the adventure. If you did, you usually broke down at least once or twice on a hill holiday, didn't you? That was just part of it, you know. So yeah. Excuse me. Your books sound really interesting. And are you? When are they due to be actually released?
They're actually out now on Kindle. The three of them are out together. In fact, I think Amazon have actually packaged them up. I said buy the three of them for whatever.
And oh right.
If you've got Kindle Unlimited, you'll get them all for nothing anyway.
Yes. So, oh, well, that's pretty good. Oh, right, okay.
They're just nice for going in and out. I mean, there'll be bits in it you'll folk will find their own stuff in it that they'll like.
I mean, with a blog, you tend to wander about, don't you? You're sort of going different places.
Because when the blog started, it was actually started as a written column for a newspaper.
Oh, right. Okay. Okay.
So it was restricted to 500 words every week.
Right.
Now,
right.
Now we tend to write generally, the normal average is about 800. It just expands them slightly. Too tight. It was just taking all the color out of it. Whereas now it's done on color and little tails. And you can take, you take one little tail and you can spin a whole new story out of it that will hold up a blog, you know.
I mean, yeah, exactly. Oh God, yeah. And I think one of the things I don't write as many blogs as I used to. I've taken up sort of podcasting, really.
Yeah.
Just because I suppose I tend to be writing. I'm writing different books all the time, and what book Wild Winter's about to come out. It's available now, like you said. But if you go direct to my publishers, but it's on general release on the 1st of April, and that's Wild Winter. I suppose I better get a plug in for my own book, really, while I'm doing this podcast.
The best cover so far. It's beautiful.
Oh, yeah, I really like the cover. Yeah, as I say, I can take no credit for the cover. That's the graphic designers. I don't argue with them. They don't tell me how to write. I don't tell them how to design a cover, you know? Fair enough, isn't it?
Well, I get what you're saying with the writing, though. I think that one of the reasons I haven't moved on too much with books is the fact that, as I say, I do this blog every week, and because we're in lockdown, I'm going to be a bit more inventive with the blogs, whereas a lot when you're able to go anywhere, you're basically writing about the trips, which is much easier to get pictures. And I've also got this newspaper column now, like I say, with a local newspaper.
What's your column?
I was approached last year by the local paper here, the Courier, and it's actually, they're linked with P&J, so it goes into both papers every Saturday. It's a walk a week, basically, and a local walk. But because it's the two papers, you've basically got the whole of Taste, Fife, Perth, Tayside, and then everything north of that now.
Sorry, which courier is this? Is this Dundee? No?
Dundee Courier, but it's
the Dundee Courier, right, okay.
And it also goes to P&J, so you've got the Cairngorms and beyond that as well. Anything above the Tayside line, basically, is there. And I wasn't too sure on it at the start, but then with what happened last year with lockdown, and I thought it was quite important, it'd be a good idea to keep preaching the hill practice, the good hill practice. And,
because
a lot more folk try to get out there now. There's also the messaging about littering. Where to go and where not to go, and warning about if you take a dog and things like this. You know, giving information.
Yeah.
I'm actually quite enjoying it. What I found, especially because of lockdown, October, November, December, I was finding all these fantastic little hills that I just always bypassed to go for bigger days.
Yeah.
And even December and January, with much tighter lockdown, I can still go out in Angus. I didn't go out in January at all, but February, March is easy. You're allowed to go in your council area. So I've just been doing smaller walks in Angus.
Yes.
And I've got a big supply anyway. But it's at the moment, it's quite good. But between that, having to write that every week and having to write a blog every week, you find you get deflected away from getting into anything deeper.
Because you
were talking about writing fiction. I was asked by somebody at Watterson's if I was interested in writing fiction. But what I want to do is almost like, not a cut and rip off of your bothy tail, but I was doing it like...
Why not rip him off?
A fictional thing, short stories, unsettling, and taking a lot of the legends of the Highlands and so on, and doing basically Scottish ghost or horror ghost, all as short stories. Try to put a new twist on them and things, but have a lot of information in it as well. So I don't know how that will go, but I've got 25, 26 ideas for stories for them. So,
That's all you need. That's all you need. I mean, Bothy Tales has been incredibly successful. I think people like it. It transports people to a different world, I think. And it takes you
a nip in and out, though, isn't it? You could go and read one
book,
through it like a continuous when you've got
I suppose that's right. I suppose that's right. Well, it's a collection. There's me knocking the mic. Sorry. It's a collection of short stories, isn't it? and collections of short stories aren't supposed to sell. But I have to say that sold very well. So I just don't know. One of the great things I don't know about your writing, I find that with the internet, you can talk to your readership far easier. Authors years ago were revered folk who sat in their ivory towers and scribbled away, and you never got near them. But now people are quite at liberty to contact you direct and tell you what kind of rubbish you wrote, you know, which they do frequently.
Yeah. Do you find that you meet folk on the hill now though that know you and
yes,
well, yeah, occasionally.
Yes. Yes, yeah. I'm usually heading the other way, but yes. No, I do. Yes. They know your name anyway.
Yeah. You know? Well, there was two sitting at the top of the Inpin one day, myself and one of the guides in Skye, and there was two guys sitting across, and one of the boys was staring over, and he came over and said, "Are you the guy that wrote the so-and-so?" And he started telling me the stories out of the book. Like I'd never heard them before. But the guy, it was funny because the guy that was with me, my friend, he says, "I'm going to have to go and buy this now." So next morning, when we met up to do something else, he says to me, "I'm on chapter 4." And I went, "What? since last night?" He says, "Yeah, I went and got it on Kindle last night and I've been reading through it."
Well, I think I've lost you a bit there. You still there?
Yeah, yeah.
Ah, cool. Audiences. Okay. That's great. Yeah, it's great to be able to do that. And it's I think it's interesting, you know, the amount that people get out of your books. I think some of the feedback, a lot of the feedback has been fantastic, you know.
Yeah. You feel as if you feel it's been worthwhile, a bit that way. So there's a lot of,
I think so. I've had quite a few people say, you know, during lockdown, they've read, they can't go out, but they've read my books, and at least it's given them some sort of feeling that so it's made them remember what the outdoors are like and remember what they miss, really, I suppose. But it's taken them out of themselves, I think. And I think at the moment, we need that, don't we, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I noticed a strange a bit of a surge on my second book, which you probably know. I did my second book off my own back with the help of the publishers, but I did it off my own back. But I deliberately didn't put it on Amazon. I thought I was being very noble by not putting it on Amazon, and it was actually just a huge mistake not doing that.
Absolutely, yeah.
If you realize, you can't win, you know.
No, you can't fight Amazon. No way.
But it is on Amazon. It went on Amazon after about a year. And folk are now discovering that book. And it's funny that Moonwalker's quite well known and the third one's quite well known, but the middle one seemed to slip by almost because of the...
Oh, right. Okay. Okay.
And yet now, during lockdown, the sales of it have gone way up and the reviews of it have been very, very good as well. And a lot of people used to say it was a better book than the first one anyway. I don't mean better in terms of mountains and so on. I just mean that there was more of a confidence in the writing.
You'd take it on a page. Yeah.
And people who'd read it said they really enjoyed that one. And also, a lot of the people who were reading it were interested in Corbett's, which I think there still is a big Munro's Corbett's thing. You know, people like Munro, like reading about Munro's, unfortunately. You know.
Yes, I've never understood it, to be honest. As you know. Anyway, listen, Alan, great talking to you. And so if folk want to get along, if you've not read Alan's books, I really recommend them. They're a great read about and a different take on the hills, climbing them at night. And then obviously, you know, you've got your ebooks out now, which are sort of all sorts of different views and little stories and stuff. So I'm looking forward to that. Anyway, well, thanks for talking to me, Alan. It's been great interviewing you, and all the best with your future writing.
Same to you.
Okay, you take care.
Yeah, bye.
Bye.